Hello and welcome to another episode of the Creative Weirdos podcast. Thank you all for being here and checking this out. It means a lot to me, especially today. I have a super special guest. I am honored to share this conversation with one of my favorite cartoonists, authors, and artists. He has made some of my favorite comics in the last couple years. Tom Scioli is here, and we talk about everything from Otto Binder to where ideas come from and just the beauty and magic in comics that is so special to it. Tom is the amazing creator behind such a wonderful comics such as I Am Stan, Jack Kirby, The Epic Life of the King of Comics, Fantastic Four Grand Design, his new comic Witchman that I'm so excited to see when it comes out, and a ton of other ones. Go follow all of Tom's work and his wonderful YouTube channel, The Total Recall Show, all linked below, and enjoy this conversation. I'll talk to you all soon. Have a wonderful day. Bye. Tom, thank you for doing this. I'm super excited to talk to you. I was just kind of explaining that I've been doing a little bit of a series on comics and the weirdness that kind of surrounds them. The specific magic that is inherent in the comics medium. And you're the first professional comic artist that I've worked with. It's a little later than I normally do these, so
yeah,
a little tongue-tied
right.
Sometimes. that is why. But you're the first professional cartoonist I've had on here, and one of the reasons I asked you before anybody else is because I just love the way you talk about comics in general. In this, it almost touches on a spiritual way and something that is you're very passionate about, obviously. And I would love to just kind of dive into some of these weirder ideas and kind of the things that comics do that no other medium seems to be able to.
Yeah. Hit me with some specifics because I like the direction you're going.
Okay,
with this.
Awesome. And
yeah.
So why don't we start with one? I'd love to talk to you about Otto Binder. That I've heard you bring up in conversations when people ask you as far as what you've thought about, if you've thought about covering other autobiographical comics. Like, you know, you did the I Am Stan and you did Jack Kirby. And what would you do next? And you've brought up that you've toyed around with the idea of Otto Binder. And I've wondered what attracted you to his story.
I mean, well, just right off the bat, I mean, I like the idea of taking somebody like Otto Binder, who, I mean, if you're like old school comics fandom, they know about Otto Binder. Like, he, you know, some of the earliest fanzines and stuff, they're, you know, Alter Ego and stuff, they're interviewing Otto Binder. They're, you know, they're digging up like old Captain Marvel scripts and things. Like, Otto Binder was, you know, like, one of the most prolific writers, one of the most sort of successful and popular of his era, you know, doing like all those Captain Marvel comics. Unfortunately, it's like so far back in the past, and it's kind of like anything, you know, pre Fantastic Four number one, like unless it's, you know, Superman or Batman, it's kind of on the junk pile of like comics history. So there is like old school comics fandom knows about Otto Binder. But I mean, that's, you know, old school comics fandom, that's before my time too. So, but yeah, he was just fascinating to me. Like, I love his body of work. Like, I think that whole, you know, Captain Marvel run and the Marvel family and all that stuff, it's just, they're great comics. They're great superhero comics. They're just great comics of that era. And I was just really curious about him. Like, I wanted to learn more about this guy. And yeah, like, you know, he had all these interesting, you know, like his life was really tragic. And writing a book about Jack Kirby and writing a book about Stan Lee, like, it's interesting where Otto Binder fits in there, because he's kind of similar to those two guys. He's similar to Kirby in some ways, similar to Stan Lee in some ways, but then like just so different in other ways. His life, it was just like so tragic and just like a lot of sadness and alcoholism and things like that. And then, yeah, like you touched on all that supernatural stuff, like, I just I don't know what to make of some of it,
Yeah.
but yeah.
No, that's that absolutely. I would love to see someone like you dive in and really uncover. And I can see why that wasn't the go-to choice because of, the familiarity with the topic and
Yeah.
everything. But it is so I came to Otto Bender's work not through comic. I've been a comics fan for a long time.
Yeah.
Never knew who he was until I got really into paranormal stuff again and came to him through UFOs because he's so well respected in the UFO community for his Our Space Age comic strip that was it was syndicated for a while. I don't know in how many papers or anything, but essentially he was doing one panel coverages of real life encounters, and they are some of the wildest encounters that you will ever like. When you read them, it's like, just super simple, like farmer sitting on a tractor at 10 p.m. and sees a saucer with two 3 foot green suited men in white helmets, and like it's just like these beautiful very basic drawings of them. And that was my first, and then I was like, this dude co-created Supergirl and like so
Right,
many,
yeah.
like Black Adam and all of this other. I love these figures that have these fingerprints on culture that people don't know about. And then they're
Yeah.
also have these side interests in like the esoteric or ufology or the paranormal. I just love how those things kind of go hand in hand. And I think comics has so many really interesting examples of that.
Yeah, and he was, I mean, he was part of this like science fiction pulp era, like him and his brother, Earl,
Yeah.
and and yeah, and then so yeah, it's like you look at the scope of his life, and it's all this stuff that I am interested in, because yeah, the early sci-fi popes, early superheroes, Silver Age superheroes, and then like yeah, 70s like UFO, Loch Ness Monster, kind of,
Exactly.
Paranormal kind of books, towards the end of his life, and yeah, hard science too. He did, hard science. And
Yeah, that was always super interesting to me. I knew he grew up in Chicago, so he was in the same that was a science fiction town. Like that was where
yeah.
Amazing Fantasy was amazing. Was that right? Amazing Fantasy, which one of the big pulps was published there.
It was there's Amazing Stories.
Amazing Stories. Yeah,
Yeah.
I think that was it. And yeah, so it's so cool to see how he grew up through that era. And I mean, he comes from an immigrant family, which I think is so prevalent with all of the cartoonists and
Yeah.
science fiction writers of that time, and has a real big impact on the way. But it was super interesting to me how he had a flip in the later in his life when he had those tragedies occur, like his daughter passing away really suddenly from a car accident, I believe, or something along those lines.
Yeah,
And
it was a
it,
car accident. It was like a teen driver, and
yeah.
she was at school, and in the parking lot or the schoolyard or whatever, and like one of the students was driving through there, and then like yeah, it was just like, and it sounds like it was almost like a slow motion
Oh.
car accident. So yeah, just this like awful tragedy, and then that was it. Like
Yeah.
him and his wife, died a couple years after that,
Have you heard of the seance story with Frank
Yeah.
Miller and everything?
Yeah, and yeah, I and that was going to be in my book too, and I was working on that, and then the book ended up not happening, and then I saw Tom King put that scene in one of his comics, and has like Frank Miller show up
Yeah.
in it and stuff. I was like, okay, so yeah, somebody else knows about this thing too. Cool.
Yeah, no, it's I came across that story from a really beautiful book called Mutants and Mystics by Dr. Jeff Kripal. He's a professor in Rice University and is just a super brilliant person, and he's really working on bringing the paranormal and what he refers to as the impossible into academia, and he's doing it through comics in a lot of ways. Like he's teaching super gods in his classes and Grant Morrison's Alien Encounter and the Invisibles and all of that stuff. And it's really, and he wrote this beautiful book where he was, so he runs an archive of essentially all of Jacques Vallée's letters and all of these different UFO researchers. They pretty much have donated this beautiful body of work, and in there are like letters from Otto Bender and letters from Barry Windsor Smith and like all these other comic artists. And you're like, whoa, these are in the middle of all these experiences. So he started pulling these out and he wrote this beautiful book called Mutants and Mystics, which essentially covers a lot of these different encounters. Mm-hmm. Like, and it's really interesting to see he draws parallels between these things happening and countercultural movements happening at the same times. And that's some of the stuff that I just love seeing, is how these kind of fictions and these modern mythologies really do have impacts on like the cultural movements. And I think you can definitely see that in the books that you've written about Kirby and Stan Lee, and like just how much these things do leave their fingerprints forever.
Yeah. And I think at that seance, it wasn't exactly a seance, but like it was Frank Miller was there. And then like one of the guys who produced the Tim Burton Batman movie was it, because it was like young, it was like comics fandom people. And Miller was a comics fandom. It was probably like 15 years old or something back then. So it's all these guys who like grew up to be like, real, forces in and around comics.
It's so true. No, it's and it's one of the things that like, those little stories that you can find in these type of areas are super interesting to me, with those people, with people that go on to have bigger careers. And like, I am glad that they are preserved and that they get out there. But I do think that it's also, before we leave Bender, he's a great example of one of the things I think comics allows, where there's so much kind of imaginal energy and workload that goes into making these things. I think Bender was like, 4,000 comics at DC or something like that, that he wrote or something, or like between the various publishers. Like, that is so much writing. One of my other favorite examples of weird stuff is the real life encounters with the Shadow, the pulp character. Have you heard about those, where people have their,
they think they met him?
Yeah, William Gibson, the house that he wrote the books in, the pulp novels in, people that have stayed in that apartment and rented the apartment later have like ran into the Shadow on the street right outside of it, or on the bottom floor, things like that. And it kind of makes sense when you think of a dude that wrote as much as someone like William Gibson did. I mean, he wrote, I think, more than anybody else, like more books under his name than like anybody else in the history of American writing, if I remember right. And like those type of things, it's interesting to me how they get very quickly associated with, with any of those paranormal accounts. I'm a big, you take it for what it is. Like, you don't have to actually believe that they ran into the Shadow. But the fact that that's what that mythology created is really interesting to me, in that, like, there is some sort of physical aspect that these things can kind of conjure, which is also very interesting. I think comics has a very special potential to do that because of how much work goes into them on the creative side, and kind of like what you've talked about before, like Scott McCloud's talked about, that it does call on the imagination a little bit more from the end user.
Like, yeah, from the reader.
Having to fill in those gaps and everything. Like, you are more invested, even if you don't realize it, you're not aware, your consciousness is more invested in this like consumption of entertainment than if you're watching a movie or reading a book or anything else, really.
Yeah, you're doing a lot of heavy lifting as a reader.
No, I think there's something really interesting to that. And I don't know, I'm definitely fascinated with the idea that there's kind of a cultural bubbling up that gets planted into different media types, and comics seems to have this like safe zone for the paranormal or something. It's like, you don't have anywhere else to go, come hang out here and tell your weird stories, and we'll give you a place to live here. And one of the things that I would love to hear you talk about that I've heard you mention before, and I know is a big part of one of your new projects, Witchman, is this kind of like horror paranormal element at the basis of superhero comics. And that's something that I just would love to hear you kind of touch on and talk about a little.
Yeah, I mean, it was just something that I sort of noticed after a while, and sort of noticed with like the comics that really seem to like capture people's imagination, like the superhero comics, because when you think of a superhero comic, like the first things that come to mind are sort of like Superman or something, where it's like sci-fi, it's a little, Metropolis, like futurism, and it's sort of like colder and Silver Age and more aspirational and sort of clean and and bright and optimistic. But I was just thinking, like a superhero like Superman, has had a hard time. Like he's had his moments, but he's kind of had a hard time catching on. Like especially when those aspects are emphasized. But then you think of somebody like Batman, who has had like, been, pretty popular, for a really long time, like through all kinds of conditions and things like that. And it's like, well, what's the difference between Superman and Batman? And why does like why is it like, people who are like really into Superman, like myself, I like Superman, but it's like you kind of have to like convince people, you're like, oh, well, Superman, he's this and he's that. He's that. Where Batman, like you don't have to explain it. Everybody just gets Batman. Everybody's into Batman. And it is like, okay, like it's not the superpowers and the flying and the aspirational and the sci-fi. It's like for super, it's like that monster aspect. The fact that he that he dresses up like Dracula or whatever, and the fact there's bats and it's creepy and it's dark and there's moonlight and things happening in the shadows. Like that is just always appealing. And when you carry that across superheroes, it's like, okay, yeah, there's like the Hulk. The Hulk is like, one of the standouts, one of the ones, of the Marvel stuff, one of the earliest ones to get sort of like a live action adaptation and things. And like the Hulk is like, it's the same thing. It's like Frankenstein, but he's a superhero, or Frankenstein and the Wolfman and Jekyll and Hyde, and so, except it's a superhero. So it's like there's that, and then even Spider-Man. Like when we think of Spider-Man, we think of like, oh, Peter Parker, and he's a nerd, and he's got glasses, and he's got a chemistry set, and he's got webs, and he's got Betty Brant, and he's got J. Jonah Jameson, giving him a hard time and stuff. We think of those aspects, which are sort of like classical superheroes, like things that wouldn't be out of place in Superman. But it's like the impact, like when you just see a picture of Spider-Man on the thing, if you kind of forget everything you know about Spider-Man, he's creepy. He's spiders. He's kind of like Halloweenish and stuff. And so, and it just seems like all the superheroes that, or like Wolverine or something, and he's got these like Freddy Krueger claws, and like you don't want to mess with him and stuff. And like he'll, there's body horror involved. Like you just go down the line, and it's like, or the Thing, even the Thing, who's kind of this like he's almost like a Muppet. He's kind of like cute and cuddly and stuff, and he's orange, but he's a monster too, and he's got all those themes. He's got all those, and it's got a lot of like the universal horror in him, and the so like there's Peter Parker's chemistry set, but then there's like Dr. Frankenstein's chemistry set and stuff. And I think so when I was so Witchman was it kind of came out of that, where I was just thinking about that kind of stuff and thinking about those kind of like the Halloween imagery and monster imagery and things. And like, yeah, I want to make like a superhero that's cut from that cloth and see what happens, see where it goes. And it just seems like, and so it just made sense to me looking back at the history of comics. It's like, oh, the through line isn't superheroes. We love superheroes, and people who are into superheroes, they see everything through a superhero lens. But it is like the through line to me was horror. So it was like the superheroes have an element, even Superman has an element of horror. There's something a little bit
Absolutely.
scary about him and alien. It's just it became so normalized to us, like we don't see it anymore. Same thing with Spider-Man. But it's there, and that was like the through line. So you'd have Batman, and you'd have Superman, who's like this weird figure, considered a weird figure back then and stuff. You got that stuff, and then you'd have like Dick Briefer's Frankenstein comics, and they went through a couple different iterations too. And then you have horror comics, and then and then into the and then the post code stuff, where like horror, you just couldn't do horror anymore. But then it would sort of, sneak in on the fringes, which I think is what, Marvel did. So it just, just kind of got me thinking that way. And just to this day, I mean, Walking Dead or something. So it's like, we think of horror as not being central to comic books, but it really is. Like
No, I love that. I couldn't agree more, and I think it's such a valid point that doesn't get brought up. And I think one of the other things that I love about comics particular in that regards is this meshing of absurdity and horror, like the humor and the horror together makes it this like perfect combination. All of my favorite stuff has it, whether it's music or whether it's like it seems to be the two things that go together perfectly if done right. And I feel like you can't the comics hit it in such a specific way of those times, and the fact that you identify that as the through line makes so much sense to me more than anything else. And that's a beautiful point. The other thing that along these lines I've heard you talk about that I really think is interesting is how a lot of the art, I'm trying to remember how you put it, cause I don't want to say, but it almost has to be off. Like there's almost like an inherent ugliness to it or off outsider art element to it that's going on. And I think that goes along with that horror theme so well, that kind of uncanny valleyness that goes on with some of those, like especially in the golden age and those type of, but I think it lasts all the way through modern comics. Like if you go through a comic book in almost any style, you see that kind of offness, and it kind of is what it's endearing or makes it more real or something. There's something to that I'd love to hear you talk about a little bit.
Yeah, I mean it speaks to me, like it's my taste, like I like to look at that stuff. Yeah, it is like and you see it a lot in the Golden Age, and I mean you certainly see it in Batman stuff where it's just really beautiful, really well drawn, really accomplished, and then like super amateurish at the same time. And it's like, it's like, it's a hard thing to fake, you know, like, and it probably isn't even worth faking, but it's just, I don't know. It just, I find it very compelling and obviously like much more compelling than somebody who's sort of doing everything right. You know, doing everything the right way. And then again, like who is doing everything the right way, you know? So, like, yeah, early Batman has it. Ditko has it. Jack Kirby has it. Jack Kirby's drawings are very beautiful, very accomplished. But, like, you know, the one thing, you know, even people who don't like Kirby talk about just, like, the weirdness and the ugliness, you know, in quotes, of it. And, like, that's part of the appeal, too.
It always has been. And these are the, like, little threads that I think are so connected to strands in the paranormal that are really interesting to me. So with this podcast, mainly I have like paranormal experts and artists on because my two groups of friends have always been in those camps. I grew up loving Bigfoot and UFOs and everything. It kind of stopped. You got out of it for a long time and then had kids. And somehow that got me back into Bigfoot and UFOs and all that stuff. And like at the same time, like I've gone through phases with reading comics and the two kind of lined up together. And like, I also had a big community of creatives that I have been able to talk to. So through this podcast, I've been exploring this connection of people that are interested in, you know, this weird subjects of the paranormal and comics or creating art in general. And there's just this like big giant thread, like almost everybody I talk to that is any kind of professional creative has an interest in these things, whether it's just passing or whether it's and that's something that I think we find, or I found from talking to people, they find these things at the same time. It's like they're finding comics and they're finding the world of the weird and ghost stories and all this stuff at the same time. Was that kind of your experience? Like, were you finding Bigfoot and UFOs and that type of stuff at the same time as you were watching like the cartoons that got you into Spider-Man or into comic books like Super Friends of Spider-Man and that stuff?
Yeah, I mean, all that stuff's super nostalgic to me, and it is like it's part of my childhood. And yeah, so it's like coming at me at the same time. But yeah, I mean, because when you're looking at comics, you're looking at, you know, and for me, it was like looking at things from another era. So like, I'd be looking at that book, Superman, from the 30s to the 70s, or, you know, like that, because there were very few comics that you could get out of the library when I was a kid. And that was one of them. So I'd take that out again and again. So it's, you know, looking at stuff, because it's like, Superman from the 30s to the 70s, as if like the 70s is the current day, but I'm reading this in the 80s, you know? So like just even the modern day that it's depicting is the past too. And I was into all those sort of like paranormal books at the same time. Like you'd go into the school library and there'd be those books about, and they would also be like a decade out of date because, again, like your school library is, it's not exactly like, maybe it's different now, but it's not exactly up to date. Although I could see somebody's school library now having something from, 2015 and not thinking anything of it. But meanwhile, 2015, that's another era. That's
Yeah,
not, that's
absolutely.
to a kid, that's like way out of, that's ancient history. Like, why do I want to,
Exactly.
read this old stuff, and so that's kind of, but yeah, I was really, captivated by all these like 70s books about Bigfoot, about the Loch Ness Monster. And I was, scared of that stuff and obviously fascinated by it. And books about werewolves and werewolfism and how to become a werewolf, all that kind of stuff.
Yes.
Like the 70, and I, it's like this interesting, there's sort of this like soft barrier between like the fictional and the real. There's the fictional and then there's the real. And then there's this like sort of gray area of stuff that's like, is probably also fictional, but there's also a lot of people that, buy it as a reality. So that area like was always interesting. And it, as a creator, that area is interesting to me too. I like playing in
Yeah.
that, like with things that like, even though, they're fantastical and I can, weave them as part of like a fantasy narrative, do resonate for a lot of people as like, something that's real,
No, I totally, yeah, that's perfect. And like there that's the thing, like the experiences, no matter what's going on. And I think there's this researcher that I love, and his name's John Mack, and he was one of the foremost researchers on abductions, right? And his whole thing was that the paranormal, the UFOs, all of this stuff, and like Carl Jung, all these people have said this like a bunch of times, but the whole point of it is that it is something that is unreal, fictional, immaterial, spiritual, whatever you want to call it, that broaches that reality and becomes physical for a moment. And the point is not the physicality. The point is to give that person a novel experience and to kind of shake them up. Because if you, what gets really interesting and what like got me fascinated about the paranormal and UFOs is when you read these real encounters and these things, you realize these people have like religious experiences around these things. It's not really like their lives are changed. And what got me super fascinated is like a whole bunch of them become artists or are artists that have experiences and like, claim or think that the creative life they live led to these experiences and things like this. And when you start looking at the tropes of the paranormal, like UFO abductions is one of my favorite. Like one of the biggest tropes in UFO abductions is missing time. And one of the ways I tell everybody that they can experience missing time is just start drawing. Like if you get into a drawing, you'll be like, where did those 8 hours go? What just happened? Like there's these certain ways that you can access these things that people, have kind of put on them unwittingly sometimes that resonate in that same area. So I think that like there is this beautiful in between and playing with those mythologies that there are true believers, for lack of a better term, and then there's like physical materialists that are like, nope, ain't nothing. And I think it's good to wear all the hats in between to kind of, and that's where like playing with these fictionally is kind of fun because yes, you're writing fiction, but you can kind of wear both hats. You can be like, yeah, like this is a real experience somebody had, but I can play the skeptical side of it as well and find the magic that is, because you need both. Like that's the point of all of it to me, is you kind of need both. But yeah, do you think you would ever tackle something like that? Like something that had like some sort of real life
When I was working on the Otto Binder story, there that was in it. Like I had the sort of tapes that he's, playing with the, backwards or playing with the sound turned up real high to hear things in the hiss. And then, depicting the, him and I think his niece saw like a UFO. And so that was, that was kind of the way to approach it. And then there's things that I wouldn't, that I don't know necessarily it's sort of like supernatural or paranormal, but there's, making comics, there's like self-hypnosis involved in it. You're like staring at a piece of paper, you're repeating drawings, like each drawing is different, but you are kind of like, you're drawing, Spider-Man or the Hulk or the Thing again and again and again and stuff. And so there's a self-hypnosis. And so there was like a moment in Jack Kirby's life where he was drawing, Sergeant Fury, who was like largely like in a lot of ways, like, he's sort of this larger than life character, but he was sort of based on, he was an autobiographical character to some degree for Kirby, and of his war experiences, things. And he's drawn him and drawn him, issue after issue. And then, they bring him into the 60s, like they take him out of the World War II thing, and he starts drawing him with an eye patch. And then, like, not too long after that, Jack starts having trouble seeing out of the eye, the same eye that he's drawing Nick Fury having the eye patch on. And it's like, could be coincidence, could be a number of things, but I think there really could be something to the idea of like drawing again and again this character that you associate with yourself, and then you make that character blind in one eye, and you start getting blind in that same eye, like that,
Totally.
that, and it doesn't seem that something that would need like a paranormal explanation, that just, but sort of, like a scientific, biological or psychological explanation, of a mechanism that we're maybe not, we don't really like understand 100%,
Totally.
but
Both are beautiful options to me. Like, it could be that, like, he had something wrong with that eye, and that was his subconscious, like, coming up, bubbling up, and
Right.
being
Yeah.
like,
Telling
hey,
him the
like,
story
something.
of, yeah, something's going on
Exactly.
here.
But it also could be one of my favorite things along these lines. There's this really wonderful writer named Eric Wargo, and he writes books about time, essentially. And he's just writing this whole book. He wrote this whole book on is it precognitive experiences through creativity. And like, these are exactly the type of things where, like, same thing with the Barry Windsor Smith, where he has these like experiences where he sees these full scenes play out in front of him that don't happen to him for like 3 or 4 years. But then eventually he's like, wait a second. This, I've seen all of this and know exactly what's happening. Or it's very similar to the Grant Morrison Invisible story, where he gives himself that horrible disease and then cures himself and decides that he can, really, really play with that whole sigil work. And I think there, it's like anything else. And it's so funny because it always comes back to these ideas that I don't think we give our imaginations as much credit for how powerful they are. And it's not that we
Right, but
can
yeah.
like, not that we can like physically change, like, I'm sick, I'm going to draw myself not sick, and then tomorrow I'm going to
Right.
heal. It's not that type of thing, but there
Yeah.
is something about the human attention and being able to focus that attention on something over and over again that can produce results in certain ways, whether again, if it's just us finding out things or unconsciously that we didn't know, and or if it's tapping into some kind of weird, the fun part about science these days is it is confirming all the weirdness. It's like, yeah, time, not a thing, like, not linear. That's out the window. We all know that's not a thing anymore. That's cool. So like, there is all these options that maybe if you do invest that much time at the drawing table, you might get these little glimpses into different timelines and time periods and stuff like that. But
Yeah,
who knows?
I mean, the thing I've been sort of fascinated with for, maybe like the past 10 years is just like the unconscious mind and how power it's so powerful. It's this like, kind of almost like godlike engine. It's this it basically it creates our reality. Like the unconscious mind translates all the things that we're all the sensations that we're getting, and translates it into like a coherent, understandable reality that we can like move around through. And then we have the conscious mind, which is sort of, like the avatar, in the video game that's moving through this world and experiencing it in sort of, a limited fashion. But the, the unconscious mind is that like, larger computer that's creating this entire, thing that we're navigating through. And so it's just so like unbelievably powerful. And you just kind of it just learning to sort of speak to that super mind or that compute that's like super powerful computer, like learning to have my conscious mind speak to it and get into some kind of dialogue with it so that it can, give me the things I need. I mean, in my case, it's for, creativity, for like storytelling and things like that. But it's and so people who keep like a dream journal or things like that, that's like, one of the ways. But it's just so amazingly powerful. And when you're trying to like be creative and create things, there are the things that you sort of consciously create. And it's just so much work to consciously create something, and then the yield is so small. But then the things that your unconscious mind just hands to you are so like powerful and beautiful, and like some of the best things that have ended up in my con were things that like I do all this like toil in the daylight hours working on this and that, and then I'd go to sleep, and then I'd wake up the next morning with like the whole thing just kind of figured out and presented to me, like whether it's in a dream or like the thoughts you have when you first wake up and stuff. So that, and again, like talking about that, it sounds like maybe, something, spiritual or magical, but it to me, it's just science. Like you're just talking about like the brain and how it works and how we understand it to work, that there's this,
Yes, 100%. That's beautiful. Have you ever looked into idealism as a philosophy? It's something that I've just kind of been dipping my toe into. There's this really beautiful thinker named Bernardo Castrop, and he was a computer scientist that worked at like the CERN laboratory and like created some of the first computers that were used in the CERN and some other large hadron collider before that. In the 90s, he built like some of the first AI software, because apparently when you're using like a large Hadron Collider, the amount of information that's created in 1 second when they're running the experiences is like hundreds of terabytes. So they had to create an AI system to decide what information to keep and what information to completely. Oh man, that was weird. My phone just started alerting me that something bad's happening.
Look out.
Oh boy. No, it's a sad one. I don't even want to read the rest of that.
Okay.
Yeah, missing kids and things.
Oh no.
Yeah, no good. But essentially he did that for a long time and then retired and went back to school for philosophy, and he became a philosopher, and now he's the leading pretty much the spokesperson for analytical idealism, which essentially is exactly what you just said. And the way he explains it is so beautiful, and it's very similar to how you kind of explained it. But he's like, it's like, think about an airplane and a cockpit of an airplane. They don't need a window to see out of the front of the airplane anymore. It's all done by
Right.
sensors. That's how our brains work. Like, we don't actually see what's real in front of us. Like,
Yeah.
our brain is computing these things and giving it its best known. And that's so, it's all like essentially exactly what you just said, that I
And
think.
comics in particular is like a visual symbolic shorthand that
Yes.
almost kind of speaks in the like the native language of that unconscious mind. It's kind of
Yes.
like it's like the code or something. It's
Exactly.
the machine
Simplification.
language.
It's what you did in this book. Like, what, why, like, this book is so different and special. I gave this to a few of my friends that are not comics readers and that have no interest in Stan Lee. And I'm like, just read this. I think you're gonna just really. And they read it in like an hour. And it's that, like, it's the language you use in here and that simplification of everything that Scott McCloud talks about as far as how recognizable things are. And I think there's also something to the simplification that makes things, besides the deeper connection, it makes them more substantial. Like the polka dot eye idea, the fact that you can represent something. Like, I was recently listening to a science podcast with my kid, and they're explaining about how the human eye works, how it takes, light into it. It has a piece of our brain that hangs out of our skull, connect to the back of it. It transfers that light using a chemical reaction into a thing that our brains can understand in a other chemical reaction. I'm like, okay, that's all like, that's magic, science, whatever you want to call it. But the fact that that can be represented with a dot and then a little white dot over top of it, there's something that's even more magical about that. And I think that's what comics do so well. And I also think that there's something about that creation of language. Like, that's one of the reasons that Kirby's work, or that era, that like that era where there wasn't a language and then there
Right.
was, there's something
Yeah.
so special to that. It is a modern language that people don't really talk about it as that, as much of that in that regard. And I think their language kind of is the other thing that defines the world around us. The way we talk about
Yeah.
things, it shapes it. It really does. And the fact that comics have this whole other way, and that it's not like a it's an evolving language. It's not a language that is stuck in time, but it is interesting to me how it evolves and how it doesn't evolve and how stuck in time it is in certain regards.
It is. There are aspects of the language of comics that it's shocking that it's like, okay, we're still using conventions that were come up with in the 20s and 30s.
To somebody interview you earlier, I just listened to a bunch of it. You're one of the few guests where it's weird because I listen to you a lot in my ears, but I also read a lot of your work. So usually I am either just listening. It's the double whammy. It's really wonderful to actually have you here and respond to the things I say. It's a whole other thing. But I was listening to somebody and they were very taken back by the pencil inking, by the pencil line instead of the ink. And I was like, people are really married to that fucking ink, aren't they? And in my mind, it was, it was part of the art form as a reproduction necessity. Like, that's like why it was created, because that was the printing production at the time. And like, there's no reason to stick with that if it doesn't serve the project. And like, what the way that you explain how you accomplish that, like, kind of feathery, warm, translucent ink line that is printed on that pulpy paper through the pencil, it like kind of blew that person's mind. And I was like, it makes so much sense to me, but they're so hung up on like, it's comics, it has to be black line and like, color underneath. And I'm like, wow, that's
I had those thoughts too, because it was a form of indoctrination. Like, I was indoctrinated into that cult of ink and the black line, and the black line is so important. But then, it took me a while to learn, like, unlearn that or deprogram from that thing. And it is like, wait a second, this thing of like deep, deep, deep black ink printed on glossy, bleached white, reflective, paper is as arbitrary as anything, and it's relatively recent. Like, that kind of started in the 90s, and we're acting like that's how comics have to be and that's how comics always have been. No, like, you go back, you go back to the early 90s and prior, and it is like, yes, artists are drawing on a piece of paper in like as black an ink as they can get and things. But that line that you're looking at as a reader of a G.I. Joe comic from the 80s or something is this like brownish, dark gray, pebbly line on this newsprint. And this is what comics looked like for like 100 years. And they were just so beautiful and this like mass medium that people were in love with. And then at some point in the 90s, it became this other aesthetic. And it's like, and that's all well, as a result of technology. And it's like, that's all well and good, but that doesn't mean that that's the only game in town, or that my comics have to look like that,
Absolutely. Marshall McLuhan is one of my favorite thinkers and media analysis analysts. but he always said that a new medium takes a while to stop imitating the medium that came before. So if you look at when movies first started, they were just stage plays filmed, right? I think comics, it moves even slower for some reason. Like, I feel, and maybe it is like the industry, and it's probably a lot of sadder things than I'd even want to think about as far as like, capital motives and things along those lines. But like, it is interesting to me how much impact comics has had on, culture in general, but how much it hasn't really shifted in certain regards and kept up with the culture. And it's like at once the biggest thing in American culture and the least biggest thing in American culture.
Yeah, it's
somehow
interesting.
That paradox is always interesting to me. And so that actually brings something else to mind. I heard you mention when you were talking about Witchman in another interview that one of the impetus of this was that you don't see people making new superheroes anymore. And that is something that I never thought about, but is super interesting. And do you have any thoughts on why, or like why that has become less of a trend?
Yeah, I don't, I mean, I guess it's like having difficulty getting any traction with new superheroes. It feels like, oh, that's new superheroes. That's a 90s thing. Like, in the 90s, everybody had their superhero pantheons. and they all largely bit the dust. There's a couple survivors from, like Spawn is still going. There's a handful of survivors, but it's just that like you can't like the conventional wisdom is that people who are into superheroes, they just care about the sort of name brand guys that are already established, the people that they grew up with or had a lunchbox of or whatever. And so, there's nothing to be gained there. That's all tapped out. And so there's, various things that fill the void. And sort of, like zombie comics, like Walking Dead, things in that vein were like one thing option. And so, there were other zombie comics, and then, maybe like 10 years ago or whatever, it was sort of these, like hard sci-fi kind of things. Like, okay, that's the, but no, it's yeah, like nobody's there trying to come up with like a new superhero. And then it's like the comics where superheroes are their bread and butter, the sort of, Marvel and DC, all the people that work for them have no interest in creating a new superhero, especially like a new, like really cool superhero, because there's, like a financial disincentive or whatever. So they don't do it there. And so, yeah, there's just, there's no place for it. Also, like the relatively recent attempts to create superheroes, to create new superheroes, to me, they're always like overly complicated. They're like, oh, you know, they and it is hard to create something that's like simple, iconic, stripped to its essence. It's hard to do that after there's been, like 100 years of people creating superheroes. It's like, where do you go that nobody's gone before and stuff? It's really hard. It is a lot easier to just kind of make something very complicated, and ornate, because that's just sort of a natural place where things go. But I think, I think there's just like a power there, and it's hard to do, but that's an area that's worth mining to me, at least. I'm like trying to come up with like, one of those things where it's like so simple and it's like, how come this thing doesn't exist already? Does this thing exist already? But mining in that area. And yeah, nobody's doing, I mean, there's just, yeah, I don't know. And for me, like I have the luxury of being able to, make the kind of comics I want to make. Like I'm not in, beholden or pigeonholed in some area where it's like I have to produce the sort of comics that, like a gatekeeper or something says like, oh, this is the kind of comic you need to make. I can make, the kind of comics I want to make. And so,
Totally.
that's
That's
where it
the
is.
that is where it is. And it's so interesting the moment we live in culture where, and I think about it a lot when I listen to like you talk about comics or like the kayfabe guys, and like specifically when people start talking numbers as far as books that are being like out there and distributed, right? Like there's no longer the chance to like, sell millions of books, right? Like there's no, that's not like a thing that really happens anymore. But there is these beautiful opportunities to find these communities that will support your work, and you can do what you want for the thousands or hundreds of thousands, whatever that number is, that like can pay your bills and keep you like supported. And that's beautiful to me. But I also get kind of bummed out because I look at how my kids experience culture, and there's a lack of cohesion. Like my 6-year-old or my almost 7-year-old now, like none of his kids watch the same things anymore. Because it all depends on what streaming services you have and what like YouTubers you watch. And it's very segmented, even at that young of an age. And I'm like, man, when I was 7, we were all watching like The Simpsons and Boy Meets World. And like, we all had these like very cultural touchstones. And something like the superhero speaks to that age to me for some reason. Like it speaks to that like cultural cohesion and those things. And I wonder if people are like unconsciously disincentivized from trying because of that. You know what I mean? Because they're not going to have a new Spider-Man, obviously. Like there's not, like I don't know if there could be a character that could do that. The same way there probably couldn't be another Beatles, or there couldn't be another, like even I was talking to somebody the other day about how there couldn't be another Apple. Like all these things are closed, and now we have these like cultural things. But like I was even like musically, I'm like, man, could there be another Green Day? Is there another, like, is that an option anymore to have like bands even that size? But yeah, like could there be a new character or a new comic that has the cultural impact that even, like, I'm trying to think of like a really recent one, and I guess it would be like The Walking Dead or something that had like a very trans medium cultural impact. Like, it's it, I don't know if those, if there's opportunities in the way that culture is consumed these days. So that, like, I think it's almost a more beautiful thing that you're investing into a superhero now, knowing, like, or not knowing that, but like, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, the world is a pretty big place, and yeah, it's like, if you can, you know, like, if you can accomplish what you want to accomplish, you know, without, you know, you don't have to sell as many records as the Beatles, but if, you know, like, if you can, you know, sell a fraction of that number, but, you know, still, you know, do the things you need to do, you know, tick off the boxes, get out of it what you want to get. I mean, even just maybe just from like a base, you know, sort of profit motive, like there's ways, you know, ways of getting what you need to without needing that sort of like all encompassing saturation. The world's a big place. There's a lot of people. So like a sliver of that can be really amazing. And yeah, I mean, you mentioned like, you know, kayfabe and stuff. And there was a conversation that I had with those guys one time on one of the episodes, and we were talking about, like, you know, you think of like a, what, like a dead end, like a dead thing that was once kind of big, like a sports cartoonist, you know, they have these like, you know, book of golf cartoons or something. And I was in France, and I was looking at these books of Patonk cartoons of, you know, things like that. And where that would have been, you know, these little paperback books of like just little one page gags about like, oh, you know, I lost my ball in the rough or whatever. And it's like that would be almost like a perennial seller, kind of, you know, back in maybe like the 60s or the 50s or the 70s or something. But just like the idea that like there could be somebody right now who's like 20 years old, who's like, I love those old sports comics, and they could be passionate enough about it and sit down and make a comic about golf or pickleball or whatever, and, you know, crowdfund it or something, you know, like, and they'd be able to make that thing that they're really passionate about. And maybe, you know, 50 people, you know, pledge something to it, but it's still like enough to, you know, get that thing out there and, you know, see what happens with it. So, like, that, you know, that's, it's just super empowering to know that it's really the passion is the fuel.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think that's very, very true. And the side to land on, it's just always interesting to me to think about things that, again, it comes a lot from looking at it through my kids' eyes. Like, how are they going to grow up and experience cultures and countercultures and these things, these shifts? And like, it is interesting seeing the way, like, there's more opportunities to create than ever, but we're all consuming more different things than ever. Like, we're all in different little silos more than ever. And like, there's some weird implications in my mind, like we were talking about before, that, like, you know, cultural mythologies kind of guide the culture. I was listening to this really smart anthropologist talk about how certain TV shows had more impact on things like social movements and racial justice and stuff like that than a lot of the politics and, like, you know, a lot of the other stuff people credit in history. And it's because people became familiar with different types of people via stories and were like, oh yeah, other people, we're people. And like, even though it wasn't a one-on-one interaction, it gave them that intro. And I'm like, yeah, there's all this stuff that, like, I think about a lot, like what it was like when Twin Peaks came on the air in 1990 and just like broke a bunch of people's brains. And there was this like kind of cultural weirdening for a minute, and how there's like less opportunities for those mass like consumption points. Yeah. And like, and it's super interesting to me how that is kind of coinciding with something that I think has been a little bit of a theme in our conversation. And that is like this simplification of creating, like these barriers that have been brought down for making things in all these different ways. And it's lining up with this kind of cultural bifurcation at the same time. So people have, like, like you said, they can be interested in golf and do like their, you know, a little fanzine and get their 50 supporters and have all that. But it could also blow up and they could, you know, sell a couple thousand copies of it and things like that. But I guess what I'm the question that I'm working towards here is, do you think that comics, the way they are now, will exist forever? Like, do you think there will always be like floppy books and like, you know, like a weekly schedule and that type of thing? Or how much of this type of the industry do you think is going to change?
Yeah, I mean, that's a big question. I mean, one of the things that you were just talking about, that there was that, you know, like I grew up in like the 80s and 90s, and you know, I remember that monoculture, that like bit, and it was really oppressive. Like, yes, it was absolutely not a fun environment, because it's just like, it felt like things were kind of rammed down your throat. You know, you turn on the radio, it's like, oh, that song again, why do they keep playing that song? Like, I don't want that, I don't want this. And that there's certain things that are like, movies have to sort of be a certain way. And when that started cracking and fissures started appearing in that, it was like such a great moment, such a beautiful, you know, moment. And I have a lot of nostalgia and I am generally a nostalgic person, but I'm not looking to go back to era. But yeah, as far as comics, like, I mean, I don't know. It's like, they always look like they're, you know, at the end of the line. And like, when you're talking about comics, it's like, what are you talking about? Because, you know, they're like, it means like a lot of things. Like, to me though, like when people say, oh, comics, is there going to be a comics and stuff? They're talking about like, is there going to be, you know, like this, is there going to be like Spider-Man and it's this month and it's new and it's part of a continuing story that has been going on for, you know, a number of years or a number of decades. And it's going to, like, is that thing still going to exist? Like, I don't, I mean, you know, but as far as like, you know, comics, the larger thing where it's like, you know, sort of like book publishers, like the, you know, like, you know, 10 Speed, who did, you know, Jack Kirby and the Stan Lee book, like that sector is doing just fine. Like, the sectors that are hurting right now are like, you know, Marvel and DC, and that sort of like, you know, monthly, thing or whatever, but like these other, you know, these sort of, traditional publishers, and then 10 Speed, like when they did, Jack Kirby, The Epic Life, they were like a traditional publisher doing a graphic novel. Now, like with I Am Stan, it's like they have a graphic novel, you know, imprint, a sub section or whatever. So like, I see like, you know, growth and health and sustainability and stuff. So, you know, it's, you know, you're going to be able to, you know, sort of read your stories of, you know, like sort of drawings and words that, you know, tell a, you know, larger story that you can sit down with, like that'll always be around. And maybe, you know, maybe it might at some point become like, you know, a little cluster of like diehards or whatever, who are like super into it and do it or whatever. Like that, I think at the very least it'll be that, but I think it'll, you know, be, you know, much more than that. I think it's more or less here to stay, but I mean, who knows, you know, like, I, you know, I don't even, you know, there's so many things that you've, you know, seemed like they'd never go away that kind of did. So, you know, empires rise and fall and things like that. But yeah, I mean, seems, you know, barring, you know, some kind of, you know, mass extinction event, seems like, totally. It seems like it's there.
No, absolutely. I agree. Yeah. And I, to go back a second, I definitely was not, what's called, would not opt for the monoculture of the 80s and 90s as opposed to what it is today. I think it is interesting how essentially like what incentivizes people to be creative and what incentivizes more than just the creativity, but community and yeah. gets people out and talking and like, you know, comics being enjoyed via bookshops and the big publishers and things like that through Barnes and Noble and or like through Patreons and things like that. It's a very different community than what people think of when they think of a comics community. And I don't think it's a bad thing that it's shifting. It's probably a yeah. good thing. It's probably for the longevity of the medium and all of that good stuff. But those shifts, and I don't ever like landing on positive or negatives, but it's a very different shift. It's a very different way that people will see, because most people in America, when you ask them what a comic book is, they think of a, you know, comic shop, and probably most of them yeah. still think of like the comic book guy from The Simpsons. Like I think that's right. still a prevalent, like, you know, thing out there. So I think all of the moving away from that stuff's not necessarily a bad thing, but what the part that I'm really interested in is what it's going to do to the stories being told, like how is it going to change the actual art that's coming out of it? Like you can kind of see how people started writing for graphic novels versus yes. like writing ish. Those type of things are more interesting to me than anything, is how are these kind of, you know, pressures from the culture and from the way this stuff's distributed going to change the way people are making comics? And it's probably going to be for the better in the long run. It's probably going to be a lot more imagination and creativity out there than I could ever imagine. But it is interesting to me, those shifts and where it's going to land with things.
Yeah, yeah, me too. I've been doing comics long enough that I've kind of, you know, it's like it's constantly changing. The ground moves beneath your feet. And I started off doing, you know, just like comics, just like single issues and things. And then the graphic novel boom happened. And then there were financial disincentives to what I was doing and financial incentives to do, you know, graphic novels. So I kind of moved into the graphic novel space. And then there were financial incentives to doing, you know, sort of, you know, very traditional comics and did those and then back to graphic novels. And then now, like I did that Jack Kirby Star Warriors and I was just kind of like blown away and so in love with the idea of doing just like a comic book, here it is. Here's my, it's a comic book. This isn't issue one of six or one of four yes. or one of 100. This is it. This is it. And this is the comic book. And it's, I'm going to make the nicest comic book I can, but here it is. And that's kind of, which man is that? It's like, wow, yes. this is kind of fun. It's like, you know, sometimes, you know, people start, you know, like a musician or whatever, or a band will go in and start doing like albums, like big statements, big albums. And then it's like, ooh, how about the single? Let's go back yes. to the single, you know? So it feels kind of like that. It's like the power of just like a really, you know, potent like single.
I don't know if you're just reading the zeitgeist, but I think that's the smartest thing people can do is go back to the single mentality in any art form right now, because that is how people consume media. Like my kid has no interest in watching an hour long movie anymore. He wants to watch 15 minutes, you know, like attention span is a thing these days. Even like yeah. I was just interviewing that professor I mentioned earlier, Dr. Jeffrey Kreipl. And he said, one of the biggest things that is different now is people don't read. Like people just don't right. read. And it's like, oh yeah, that's a really good point that, like, you know, it seems very common sense, but it kind of is, it's one of those things. It's like, oh wow, that's so, going back to that kind of self-contained story, that single, and really putting everything into that one unit, like, and that yeah. one, like, it makes so much sense. Like I'm sure that's not how you're thinking about it, but it is funny because that it does align with like what I've kind of been picking up from the zeitgeist, as it were.
Yeah. And I mean, as somebody who allows his unconscious mind to sort of maybe take him places that he doesn't quite fully understand, it's like there's, you know, something in there yeah. is maybe aware of these like no. larger trends and sort of, yeah. you know, pointing me in that direction.
This is absolutely, so I've been going for about an hour. I forgot yeah. to ask you how long you have here, but I don't want to take up too much of your evening. I know
sure,
before
yeah.
we start recording, we said this is drawing time for you. So that's much more important right. than rambling about stuff with me here. But this is a great place to kind of wrap up. where do you kind of think ideas come from? Like, are you a consciousness is not in a local thing type of believer? Or what's your thoughts on those things? Are you tapping into something and receiving? Or do you have any specific models you like to play with about that stuff?
Yeah, I mean, it can come from many places. And I've operated in many different ways. And yes, there is conscious creation where you kind of sit down and think a little, and you're like, oh, I'd like to do that. I'd like to do something with this, this, and this. And you kind of, you know, puzzle with it and you get to a certain point. And then there's like, you know, when people talk about those moments where it's like, you know, Paul McCartney wakes up and yesterday is in his head, except it's scrambled eggs. And so, you know, and it's like this gift that his unconscious mind, like I don't think that it's come from like outside of you, but I mean, it can feel like it came from outside of you, but it's that like unconscious mind, this sort of super computer, this like God computer that contains the whole universe inside of it, that can, and is also, can be, you know, kindly and benevolent. It can also, be like a nasty torturer. It can be a trickster. It can be all those, like all these, you know, gods of antiquity that we were, you know, like they are representations of like all these different things that are just going on inside these you know, wonderful brains of ours. And to me, that's where like the real good stuff comes from. It just kind of spits out, and it's like, and just being able to kind of have a relationship with that side of your psyche, and hopefully it'll like sort of slide you the answer that you need when you need it. And that's just part of a creative life. And even like just a couple of days ago, like I had this dream and there was like a song in it. It was like the Rolling Stones made a Christmas song in the 1960s. Like, I don't know if they really, I don't think they ever did, but in this dream there was, and they're playing it and I hear it. And, you know, and then I woke up and I'm like, yeah, let me try to remember this song that the Rolling Stones were playing. And then I recorded it, like I recorded my rendition of it. So it exists. And I haven't listened to it since then. And I completely forget, you know, what that song was, but it's like on my phone somewhere and stuff. So again, like there's like the Rolling Stones exist somewhere in that, like in here, like in my brain somewhere, the Rolling Stones, because for me to be able to understand the Rolling Stones and listen to their music and have a sense of like, oh, there's, you know, Mick Jagger and there's Keith Richards and all that kind of stuff, there, my conscious understanding of those things, behind that there needs to be a something making the larger sense of every bit of that information. So inside my brain is like an almost almost perfect replica of the Rolling Stones, and they can create songs for me. You know, it's not, they, you know, if I tell my brain to do that, it's not necessarily going to do that. But maybe if I tell my brain to do that enough, I'll go to sleep and then the Rolling Stones will play a Christmas song for me.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Have you ever played around with any of the kind of sleep work? Like Salvador Dali was famous for falling asleep while holding a metal spoon.
A key.
And then it would drop. Have you ever played around with
that? Yeah, it's like sleep deprivation and things like that. And I do try to, like, especially if I'm like really working on some like intense deadline driven project, I try to, like, you know, just kind of tighten that loop of like, you know, wake up, get right to work, and then, you know, and maybe even like take a nap in the middle of the day and then wake up and you know, get right back to work. Yeah, like when I was working on Transformers versus G.I. Joe, it really was like I was working around the clock. And I'd have some problem or something, you know, some draft I'm working on and whatever. And then I wake up the next morning and it's, the problem's been solved for me. Yeah. And I just sit down and, you know, just sort of take notes of what, you know, this mental computer has spit out.
there's something to that surrender that is so hard as humans to go back to my kid playing video games for the first time. The amount of times I have to be like, dude, you just got to walk away for 5 minutes and come back and you'll get it. And it's the even walk, at that, and they just never, it doesn't sink in, you know, it's the remote throw and the, all that fun stuff. But no, there really is something to that surrender and moving on and then just letting it kind of bubble up. Do you have anything you do to kind of prime the wheels a little bit to get those things going, or is there any kind of is there any kind of thing that kind of gets you in the I'm in love with the book The War of Art, and have you ever read that, Steve? It's essentially, you know, ways to prime yourselves to connect with the muses and stuff and things like that, like that whole idea of keeping a schedule but keeping it loose enough to where you can break the schedule, and how you know, creativity lives in this play of structure and anti-structure and like finding ways. Do you think about that kind of stuff consciously, or do you play with those type of things?
No, I do for sure. And I mean, there was a point where I was working in a very like austere environment, like a very empty environment, very like nothing, you know, like, okay, I'll be able to focus. And it didn't work for me at all. And so what I need is like, I just need a bunch of comic books lying around and stuff, and then just kind of like lay down and just kind of, you know, just like looking through a comic book. And then all of a sudden the daydreaming starts, and then you start, you know, like, but I need something like that to kind of, because the act of reading, like we were talking about, and the act of reading a comic is a creative act also. So it kind of, you know, kicks that into gear. But I mean, I've been doing this stuff so long though, at this point, it does come pretty easy. Like it does, like the, you know, and it's just all those years of like work and repetition that now, the stuff just sort of flows pretty easy.
Yeah, it makes so much sense. I always like David Lynch's metaphor that it's a path, and the more you walk that path, the more the grass and everything gets worn down, so it's easier to access that path. And what's one of the things that I like that he talks about that gets a little weirder is you wearing that path makes it easier for others to access that path. So you're actually doing something really good for folks. Like, you know, people talk a lot about how they seem to create better at nighttime, and like, you know, they'll theorize that like, oh, it's because it's quieter, there's not as many people up, or there's not as much stuff going on, I don't have these like distractions from emails and phone calls, and all that stuff's probably true. But I also really like the way that David Lynch talks about it, where actually almost all creative people are working at the same time, and they're kind of accessing that idea sphere, so it makes it easier for everybody to access, because the doors are open and the traffic's flowing. So like, you know, it's not that less people are up, it's that more creative people are creating, so you're tapping into that like global universal creation. And I don't know, I always resonated with that and think there's something fun to it, because since I had kids, I had to switch my schedule completely. Like, I don't draw at night anymore, but I wake up at 4 a.m. every day and like the first, like just start drawing right away in the kitchen. And I realized that like I can get that same feeling as when I would stay up to those hours.
Yeah, because it's
like,
dark. Yeah.
It's dark and like no one's up, and you kind of have that same.
It's your own personal. I would say you're like more creative in the morning. Like that. I mean, just my own experience, but it's like, when you wake up and you're coming out of that dream state, there's like a lingering effect, a lingering dream effect that you get in the morning that you don't get at night, because you've been, you know, you've been at it all day. I think the sort of calm and the creativity that comes at night, you know, they talk about like sundowning and things, how, you know, and I think that, you know, probably operates, you know, for everybody to some degree, and you know, where it's like it gets dark, it gets to be nighttime, and your brain starts to shut down a little. So like during the day, there's just too much. Your brain's just doing too much, and you just can't, it's just like kind of overwhelming or whatever. And then at night, stuff starts shutting down in your brain, and then it's like, okay, now I can actually like do some creative work, because I'm not, you know, snowed under by all this, like all this, you know, nonsense or whatever, all this like flaring that my brain's doing. So it feels like, oh, I'm kicking into high gear. My brain's going into high. It's like, no, it's going into low gear, because it was doing all this unnecessary stuff during the day.
And that lines up so much with so many beautiful things. Like, you know, like the way psychedelics work on the brain, it doesn't add anything. It actually shuts things down. And theoretically it's opening us up to access something that we could access all the time. It's just our brains are too busy doing stuff. But that was always fascinating to me that, like, you know, it doesn't add any. Caffeine's the same way. Caffeine's right. not adding
it
anything.
Blocks
it's,
things.
It blocks
yeah.
things. And it's like, man, there is something to that dampening that allows wherever the hell these ideas and all that stuff comes from to happen a little bit more easy or something. I don't know.
Yeah.
There's definitely something to that. That's beautiful. Tom, there's like 5 other things I've written down here, mainly about Kirby that I didn't get to talk to you about at all, but I don't want to keep you too much longer. I feel bad whenever I get over it.
Like, yeah, it'll give us, leave them wanting more. You know, we'll have something to talk about for next time.
I hope this was a fun conversation for you.
Yeah.
I feel like it was a little different than what I usually hear you talk about. And I had a blast. And like,
me too.
Really am like, honestly, I don't know if I've said it yet or not, but I'm just a huge fan. And like, your work means a lot to me. And you're one of those people that is rarer to find where it's not just the work, it's the way you talk about it, it's the way you present it, it's how thoughtful it is behind it, it's how intentional the work is. So like, I thank you for being an artist that puts all of that other stuff out there and does the Total Recall show and does the, like, I mean, again, I'm sure you've heard this a bunch, but like, my relationship with Kirby was so enhanced by what you do with the YouTube channel and like what you do in general with his work. And I think that's something that is, you need to get your flowers for it because it's something that's very important for these things. And yeah, I mean, I'd love to have you back on to really dive into Kirby and his whole connection to the source. And like,
yes.
I mean, that dude,
yeah, he's
was
a mystic.
On,
yeah.
Yeah. He was a mystic. He was putting down some stuff on those pages that like, I don't know where it came from or if he knows where it came from, but there's like
the collective unconscious would be my guess.
Yes, 100%, 100%. Well, please tell people anything you would like them to find. I'm going to, like I said, do a proper introduction here before the podcast. But yeah, whatever you'd like to share with folks, and I will make sure I link it all and all that good stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I have the Total Recall Show channel on YouTube where I just talk about all kinds of things. And sometimes it's me by myself talking about old Kirby comics or something. And then sometimes it's me and my co-host Matt Zioli, and we cultural commentary, do movie reviews. And I also have a Patreon, where you can check out, whatever's on my drawing board at the moment, I'll put up on there, and you can see, various projects I'm working on, for the past few years that I've been doing it. So most of my output has been on there. So like, the comics that I've been making since, I guess 2020 or so, they're on there. And then, you can follow me on Twitter at Tom Scholey and on Instagram at Tom_Scholey.
Awesome. Well, I'll make sure I link all that. Is the auto binder stuff, do you have that on the Patreon? Like, do you have any of that? That's like,
I think I have a page or two of it, because again, it was in like a very rough conceptual state. I think maybe there's like a page or two of some of the stuff. And I was mainly in like information gathering.
Yeah, yeah.
I'll have to take a look and see what documents I have. I probably have some kind of like pitch or something and a few pages. And again, I was going to take a different approach than I took with the Jack Kirby book. And some of the stuff ended up, like some of that approach ended up in the Stan Lee book, but it was like Otto Binder, it was a lot of like, there was a lot of music and like Oktoberfest kind of stuff.
I love it.
Like
I
in,
love
his,
it.
In his younger life. And so kind of captured like it's going to be like a little more musical,
yeah.
than some of my other comics a lot of drinking and stuff. I was trying to capture that in comics, the sort of like, polka music and stuff like in a.
Yes. I love it. I love it. Well, if it ever comes to be, I will definitely enjoy it. But again, thank you so much for doing this, Tom. I hope to get to do it again. And yeah, enjoy.
Okay. Thanks. You too, Tom.